I think the most important part to remember when you are trying to sell these big deals is that they're all human beings on the other end. They all have opinions and they all care about the experience they're being given.
How did you go about winning like the hearts and minds of the actual individual sellers?
So I think it's helping them reach that one number, which is their quota ticket.
We always have listener questions. So it says, from a founder, since we're thinking about bringing on our first few advisors for our company, what should we be looking for? Any advice here?
Experience doing what you want the advisor to advise you on.
What's one tactic or strategy that's working for Jellyfish right now?
Curated dinners, getting our prospect and customer in the room. It's that, and it's just high quality content production. But ultimately, I think it's just getting people in the room.
Behind the scenes, it was a small group of people that were doing everything.
Slow is smooth and smooth is fast.
I want to know how this insane growth actually happened.
What are you doing when no one's around, no one's looking? Are you just showing up and doing the minimum? Or are you approaching it like a pro? Be a student of the game.
This episode is brought to you by POCUS. POCUS turns data into revenue. It's really that simple. They help you combine all product usage and intent signals your team needs to prioritize the best opportunities and take quick action. POCUS helps you build pipeline based on real buying signals, not your team's best guess, whether that's landing new logos or expanding existing ones. With POCUS, go-to-market teams at Asana, Canva, Miro, and Loom, incredible companies, save 10 plus hours a week digging through data to find and close deals with confidence. So if you want to create focus for your team with POCUS, go see it in action by requesting a demo at POCUS.com/demo. That's POCUS.com/demo. And let's get it rocking. Hello and welcome back, everyone, to the GTM podcast. Scott Barker here. Always appreciate you rocking with us. And this episode will not disappoint. This is one of those episodes where I just get to jam with a good friend of mine that I haven't got to catch up with in a while. So this podcast is perfect for that. It has been, man. I'm joined by Kyle Lacey. Kyle, what's up, man? Welcome.
I'm doing good. It's good to see you.
Good to see you too. And you're in the thick of it right now. For those listeners, Kyle is on heavy dad duty this week. Your wife she's launching a new business, right?
Yeah, she launched a personal training business here in Indianapolis, and it's going exceptionally well, which means that I have more time to spend with my children because she's at the gym, which is always good.
That's awesome. When we get to support our partners doing cool new things, it's awesome that it's going well for her. So quickly, for those listeners, many people know Kyle Lacey, and I'm sure you've heard of the name if you listen to this podcast. But Kyle spent really the last 17 years building, scaling, failing, and winning in high growth software companies. Currently the CMO of Jellyfish. And before joining Jellyfish, he was building a company called Lessonly, which many of us have probably heard of. Employed over 230 people, changed the lives of many after that big acquisition that you had, and been also fortunate enough to lead teams at Seismic after the acquisition, OpenView, Salesforce, and ExactTarget. But you always highlight this, that most importantly, you're a father of two wonderful boys and an energetic dog, which is awesome. And a World War II buff.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, as you approach 40, you just kind of turn into a World War II buff. So I'm 4 months from 40. So it's just happens.
It just happens. Yeah. It's just the natural progression of life. What about that time period like draws you into it, other than the fact that there's just a lot to unpack?
Yeah, geopolitical. I mean, the fact that an entire world was drawn into one conflict's pretty amazing. But you can put World War I in there as well. But I like the time frame, and it's not that far removed. My grandfather was, both grandparents were in it.
Important to always read history. Best predictor of the future for sure. So awesome, man. Well, I want to just dive right into it. We're going to cover a lot of ground today. But one of the things I appreciate about you as a CMO, because I look at you as a very creative person. I've seen you launch a lot of interesting things, you know, including a clothing brand that a lot of CMOs and software maybe don't do. So I think of you as, you know, ultra creative, but something that stands out is you also thread this needle of really always harping on the fact that like numbers matter, you know, pipeline models matter, bookings forecasts matters, and alignment across all of that is super important. And I think, you know, when we look at early stage companies and software companies, which is a lot of folks that listen to this, marketing is maybe first seen as more of a creative endeavor. Why do you think it's important to focus on those numbers kind of from the get-go?
Well, I mean, I think I come across too many early stage companies that don't have a pipeline model. So they are making bookings forecasts and bookings models on what, I don't know, the founders think or the board thinks, and it's not backed by any useful data for the rest of the team. And I think that foundationally is what's needed at early stage companies so that you have goals to work against outside of just a revenue number. And for marketing, I think it's easy for marketers to be creative and make something look good. I think it's much harder for them to align with sales as the company scales, right? And I didn't mean that to rhyme and sound like a Dr. Seuss book, but the most important thing is that, you know, marketing can do all the culture and brand and creative and top of funnel work. But as you grow after seed, series A, series B, series C, alignment to your counterparts in the go-to-market org is very important. And that starts with the pipeline.
I guess, how did you, on a personal level, start being seen really as like an equal to your CRO or your SVP of sales? Because, you know, I talk to a lot of marketers and they will say that, you know, on that C-suite, you're around the board, usually your CRO or your VP of sales, his voice might, or her voice might outweigh that of the marketing professional. But you, I've seen you come into all these organizations and really hold your own and even maybe tip the balance in marketing's favor. How are you able to do that?
Well, I think it's okay to take second chair to the sales leader, especially in growth stage. It's okay. All the marketers are listening. It is okay for you to be second fiddle to the sales leader. I think for me, it's owning the same numbers. Like I'm not going to be celebrating a top of funnel pipeline number if we're not hitting our bookings goal and only half the sales team is meeting quota attainment. You know, and that's the disconnect that I think a lot of marketers have sometimes, where it's like, you know, MQLs are great, but the sales reps are just sitting there going, well, none of them converted. What are you even talking about? And then that kind of disconnect between the two orgs just festers as you add more people, especially if you're scaling. And I think the year of efficiency and all this stuff changes some of it, but that's the main thing is own the numbers together and be just as bought into your sales leader meeting 100%, 90%, 100%, 100% plus a quota attainment as they are.
So you own the same number as your counterpart. Don't celebrate, you know, wins if the revenue number is not where it needs to be. How did you go about winning like the hearts and minds of the actual individual sellers? Because that can be tough too, right? You're rolling out new enablement material you need them to use. You got new messaging, you got positioning. But that can fall on deaf ears if there's not, you know, inherent trust.
Well, it starts with speaking their language, right? And making sure that they're given the materials needed to win deals, whether that's competitive or enablement, anything under enablement. And for me personally, it's supporting people through the sales process. So if a rep is stuck trying to get in touch with somebody or wants to elevate the experience of a deal, I'm 100% open to, you know, brainstorming with that rep. And I've done that in every company that I'm in to say, hey, why don't we try this idea, whether that's a different type of swag or gift or pitch, to kind of get in touch with people, because the experience is really all that matters for the prospect of the customer. And so I think it's helping them reach that one number, which is their quota attainment. And that's, I mean, we both know that that's the reason that marketing exists, is to drive sales ultimately, whether that's through brand or through demand.
I mean, if you're helping them with quota attainment, they will follow you into battle for sure.
Yeah.
How do you, because I used to think about this a lot at Outreach, you know, when I was part of the marketing org, there is this idea of like proactive marketing and then reactive marketing, where you build a sophisticated plan for your year and you're like, okay, we're going to go to these events and we're going to spend this on advertising and we're going to sponsor these communities. We're going to do this. But if you're too rigid in that plan, opportunities will present themselves. You know, an example, say you've got an enterprise rep who has three very similar looking personas in Philadelphia, and they want to do something fun to surprise and delight those, you know, pipeline opportunities. Do you build that into your model of this ability to be more bespoke or reactive?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think it very much depends on the type of thing. Like events, you know, in territory events are a much harder thing to do regularly, right? Especially depending on the size of the team and the budget. But as part of a tiered account structure, you know, where there's a list of accounts that AEs need to get in front of and BDRs need to get, especially in a sales-led org. I think product-led is a little bit different discussion. But, you know, you build those tools, and you know this from Outreach, right? You build those tools for the reps to use, whether that's postal or it's events or it's different type of outreach sequences or different type of deliverables to help with getting in front of people, thought leadership, speaking at events, that type of stuff. I think it should be built into the entire model and the entire journey from prospect to customer.
And then that case, like marketing feels more like a tool in their tool belt versus something that's happening over here that hopefully will trickle down.
Yeah, it should be integrated completely into the sales process. And it's not just stage one. Like it should be stage one through close. If not after that, for expansion, which is a whole other thing that marketing needs to be a part of.
Well, let's talk through some real tangible examples of that, of this idea of working with your sales team to surprise and delight and ultimately win large deals. I know that you had a big hand at your time at Lessonly, winning a large seven-figure deal. And you beat out your incumbent, big public company. You know, let's jump in a time machine, fly you back to that era and walk me through that deal and kind of how it all came to be.
I mean, I think the most important part to remember when you are trying to sell these big deals or sell any deal where there's multiple people involved, which is pretty much everybody now, right? Every deal size. Is that they're all human beings on the other end. They all have opinions and they all care about the experience they're being given, whether you're selling to an L&D leader or an engineering leader or a marketing leader. And so for this big deal, we just went above and beyond on the experience of the prospect. So if we were in front of their procurement team and that company was sponsoring the Final Four, we made cutouts of all of their executives and put shirts on the color of their company. And we had like a background of our employees cheering as we were talking to their procurement team. There, I guarantee you. Now, granted, somebody could be listening and think, well, it could have went the exact opposite way. They could have been like, these people aren't a joke. Like, why would we ever? But we had spent enough time with them where we understood. We understood that was okay.
People always have this fear of like, oh, we're going to come off unprofessional. Like, I've never seen it go that way. I've never seen someone on procurement or any meeting either, where there's just a stonewalled asshole. Like, I don't think that happens, at least not in SaaS, you know?
No. And that's, and so, and then another example was we had a dinner with this company, our competitor. So you could do like up to a certain amount for a gift for all these people that were at the dinner. And it was like $100. And our competitor bought them Patagonia jackets or something with their logo on it. And we said, all right, well, this is learning and development, and we want to give Donors Choose gift cards to every single person so they could give $100 to a teacher in their community. And I've used that play ever since. Like, I'll use Donors Choose gift cards every day of the week because it's meaningful you know, you can email me about a $100 Amazon gift card. I would much rather give $100 to a teacher in my community or a teacher that's teaching my son right now. Right. So I think it was just the little things that we did that were not scalable that made the difference for us in that deal. And it was our first seven-figure deal. There's a lot of stuff that went on, of course, through the sales process that wasn't just the cool marketing driven ideas, but it's usually the illogical and the kind of like, hey, print out big heads of their executive team and see if it works. It's usually the illogical that surprises and delights people during the sales process, because most people just don't think that way. They don't think maybe we should recreate the stands of a college basketball game for this procurement team. I mean, it just was stupid if you think about it, but it worked.
I love it. I mean, and you got to think, especially in this reoccurring revenue model that we all play in, like you're buying this software, but you're buying the team and you're, you know, hopefully you've purchased well and you're going to be using this software for the next, you know, 5-7 years. So you're going to get to know these people really well. So showing this level of creativity and thoughtfulness, you know, that to me shows like that's how they're going to approach problems in the future with the same amount of thoughtfulness, which is big. And I love this donor choose gift cards. I want to shout that out because you can tie it to kind of the problem that you're solving, which you would assume that if they are purchasing that, they really care about that, right? Their kind of their role is surrounded around that.
I do it for, hey, come give me feedback on website copy that we have now. I'll give you, spend an hour with me, engineering leader, give me feedback on the product. I'll give you a $100 donor shoes gift card. Instead of just some go buy some coffee type stuff. It's a donation, so you can do with that what you will, but it's just a better idea, in my opinion.
Yeah. How many times, I have to ask this, how many times have you converted someone into a customer by asking them for website feedback? I feel like you've probably done that. And I'm sorry to blow up that play if that's a play you run.
Actually, the better play is interviewing them for either a piece of content or a podcast or some type of content series. That's the better play. I mean, we had a couple six-figure deals that Leslie come through because of just being introduced through an interview process. We landed a customer at Jellyfish because of our podcast. So there is also, and I'm preaching to the choir here. I'm talking to the person that pretty much invented. I'm pretty sure you gave me that idea, to be honest with you, when I was at Leslie. But that it works for sure.
It does. It does work. I think it's more common now, so it might not work quite as well. But yeah, it was very much a pillar play that we ran. I've called it just the podcast play at Outreach. But I think it goes beyond that, and it's always evolving as kind of best practices get widely used. But to me, and I know you share the same idea, is like, how do we create spaces for non-commercial relationships to bloom or foster before we have to have a commercial discussion? Because like smart people, if they like each other and they're in a similar space, will end up wanting to work together. That's just what happens, you know? And so the more surface area you can create to start building those relationships with like-minded people focused on similar problems, you know, it can't help but pipeline follow the other side.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think in building the community aspect of that and just remembering that there are human beings on the other side of this landing page or whatever the hell you're putting out there. They're all human and they all want to be listened to. And it's just depending on who it is and the use case and the persona. And I think everybody's different, marketing, sales, engineering, like R&D, but that's marketing in my mind.
A quick pause from this interview to talk through some of my time spent inside various high growth sales organizations. It was always pretty clear to me how much time was spent on the operational bloat of actually running that organization. We were spending so much time evaluating multiple forecasting vendors, tracking down our reps to get their updated pipelines, or waiting on sales ops or rev ops to send us the dashboards we needed to do our jobs. And that was always at the expense of closing deals.
If that sounds familiar to you, our partner Cinch lets you put all that hassle and headache in the past. Cinch is a single platform for all of your sales and sales ops tooling, from using natural language to build dashboards that will make your RevOps lead jealous, to getting forecasting, pipeline management, and lead routing from a single vendor. Cinch allows you to spend more time driving the business forward. If you want to learn more, head over to withcinch.com. That's with S-Y-N-C-H.com. Now back to the interview.
Another thing that you've done a really good job at throughout your career and you've made a priority is your personal brand. And I think we talk a lot about the benefits of it. We've both been beneficiaries of building personal brands. But you have a funny story that almost got you in trouble. And so I'd love to
hear
the flip side. It did. Not almost. It fully got you in trouble. I would love for you to share that story as well, and then maybe kind of some learnings and how you've adapted since.
Yeah. I think I can use the brand name now, but I was at ExactTarget, which was a very large email marketing, email, social, SMS platform that is now the marketing cloud. So this was 2013, 2014. I was hired to go speak at conferences. I had written Twitter Marketing for Dummies. I was a social media, if you want to call a thought leader. That's all they hired me to do. I'd go speak. So I was, I'd had a strong following on Twitter, strong following on LinkedIn. I'd been building my personal brand for years. And I was jumping on a Delta flight, leaving Heathrow to come back to Indianapolis. And my TV, so this was 2014. So like TVs and seats, and you have a long flight. You're like, hell yeah, this is what I wanted. This is awesome.
I'm watching three movies that I haven't caught up on yet. Yeah,
I've got Superbad on here. I'm gonna watch Superbad. My TV was the only one that didn't work on the entire plane, and so I took a picture of the screen and I tweeted it, and I said at Delta, and it was more like, ha ha, this is a pain. And I landed in probably LaGuardia, and I turned on my phone and I had text messages everywhere. My email, our CMO, the CEO had emailed me. And this is I think we were 1,700 people then. And apparently our social media platform had went down, and my tweet was the only one that got through the system to the head of social at Delta while I was in the air. And they were like, the head of social from Delta is your thought leader tweeting to us complaining while your system's down. It's the system they use for customer service. And I almost, if it wasn't for Jeff Roars, who was my boss at the time, who's now at ActiveCampaign, if it wasn't for him, I probably would have been fired. And that happened. I didn't learn the first time, and it happened a couple more times where finally I just said, you know what, you got to have some rule around, you know, when you complain about brands, especially if you are a marketing platform that supports like retailers. But I learned pretty quickly that you need to think before you tweet or X, whatever you call it now. But it's I was mortified.
I can imagine. And that's a terrifying way to just, you get service again and just blown up.
Especially, I was a year in. This is my first like real job out of owning an agency and failing miserably. And ExactTarget was my best customer. And the CEO of ExactTarget has been like my career mentor for years. It was just terrible. So I learned pretty, I guess I didn't learn because I did it one more time and I had to be scolded again. But it was definitely a awakening moment for me.
I imagine that makes you know, think a little bit more about, you know, what you're tweeting out there, posting. How do you walk that line now of like, you know, encouraging people at Jellyfish to, you know, have a point of view, share their thoughts and ideas while still, you know, saying, hey, don't at tweet our big customers if you are complaining?
I mean, you can have an opinion, and you should have an opinion because opinions build brands, frankly. But it shouldn't be negative or detrimental towards a brand. You know, if you're tweeting about a customer service experience, you're posting on LinkedIn about something that was negative, and that's fine. Usually it's the same concept of what we were talking about earlier, where we all think that it's going to blow up in our faces, but the reality is that it's probably okay. But if you go off on a tangent and just rip apart a brand, and it goes too negative, then I don't think it's worth it. It isn't worth it to do it to begin with, but it really depends on the business that you're working for. Like for me, working for Jellyfish and selling to engineering teams is a little bit different than like if I were at Sprout Social, as an example. But again, I think it's having an opinion is fine. Just don't go negative. Don't go too negative.
Yeah, it's funny. You see some of these more contrarian folks building their brands. And the shitty thing is usually that type of post performs quite well.
Well, they're usually sole proprietors, right? Like, they're like, which is fine. Do whatever the hell you want.
Yeah. If you're trying to follow their advice for growth, make sure you check if they're part of a company or they're just, you know, running their own LLC. ACK is very, very different. Okay, cool, man. So we always have listener questions, and I picked this one out beforehand because I would love your thoughts on it. I think you have a good point of view. Both of us sit on the advisory board for an awesome company called Postal, and this company's right in line with that. So it says, from a founder, it says, we're thinking about bringing on our first few advisors for our company. What should we be looking for? Any advice here?
Experience doing what you want the advisor to advise you on. I see way too many examples of advisors being hired that don't have the stage experience or don't have the needed, like, if you don't have seed experience, then you shouldn't be an advisor for a seed stage company. Now, I think that's mostly on the CEOs and the founders and the VCs that are allowing that to happen, right? To hiring these people that are pretty good echo chambers on social, but don't have the experience necessary. I mean, you could talk a good game, but unless you've been through it, it's just so difficult to help people think through like what the next step would be. And every business is different, but that's my number one piece of advice. If you're going to do advisors, make sure they've had experience in the stage that you're at and where you want to go.
Yeah, get super specific with it. Be like, hey, what are our three biggest challenges we're having right now as an organization? Let's go find and map out the top 10 demand gen leaders at the seed stage company or whatever it is. And just like, look at them as if I was going to go and hire a consultant, you know, that's what you're doing. This person's going to consult for a very specific thing in your business. And instead of giving them money, you're giving them equity. And yeah, I think a lot of people fall victim to like, oh, I want this person because they have like this really sweet resume, but it's all like Series D and like pre-IPO companies or even like public companies.
Or mostly private equity or whatever, right? Like if you want an advisor that's your buyer, that's a little bit different. Like they don't like if you want an advisory board of prospects, fine. But if you're looking for people to advise the growth of the company, it's got to be people who've experienced what you're trying to do.
That's a good thought. There's kind of like different levels of advisors, right? Like I think you probably want to diversify a little bit of like, okay, do we want to get in the head of our buyers? And so maybe it's helpful getting, you know, a well-known buyer in the space who is respected amongst their peers. And then maybe we do want like an advisor who's more of a distribution engine, right? Like someone just who can get us a ton of eyeballs, but don't confuse that person with the person who's going to get their hands dirty and like, you know, build your pipeline metrics and, you know, help you with your tech stack, because then you can get into some dicey waters for sure.
And on the company side, it's going to be a very different agreement between the person building your pipeline model and coaching your marketing leader or sales leader, whoever, than an advisor who is helping on the social, you know, the influence side, the community side.
Last point I'll say there is I would almost at the early stage, like get your aspirational CMO that you can't afford yet, or your aspirational CRO that is early stage. You're like, I think we could hire this person in like a year and a half. And like, that's a perfect way to get to know them. Kind of like they get to try before you buy. It can be a good way to de-risk a very important hire.
And you can even, I mean, situations that I've been in as an advisor, I've helped hire the marketing leader to come into the company. And I think that's a good way to help CEOs and founders think through what a first marketing hire is, or what a second marketing hire is, or how do you coach somebody through those first 90 days, and of especially if they're more junior and they need that experience and they need that mentorship.
That's big. Kind of helping them triangulate what excellence looks like, particularly, you know, you're a technical founder, you got to go hire your first VP of marketing. Like, where do you even start? You know, and this person can help that. Awesome, man. Well, this has been fun. It's always jam. And I got two more questions for you. And then I'm going to let you go pick up your kids. I always keep these the same. They are intentionally vague. So take it wherever you want. And I didn't prep you with these. So first one is, what is one widely held belief that revenue leaders or founders believe to be true that you think is bullshit, or at least no longer serving us?
Oh, influence being something that we should talk about. Influence pipeline, influence dollars. I could never get on board, honestly. So that's the first one for sure.
Let's double click on that one. So all these sophisticated models that people tried to build for attribution of like, no, this person back in 2017, they read this blog post we did, and so, you know, we should get 5%. Like, that's all. You're just like, forget about it all.
I don't think forget. I mean, we have attribution modeling at Jellyfish. Like, I don't think forget about it, but if you're using that as like a main success metric, you're missing something, because a rising tide lifts all ships, and you should be able to look down and think tactically in your spend and how efficient you are and all that stuff. But if you're talking to me about 50 touch points in a sales process and dark social and all this other stuff, like, maybe I'm getting old, which I even hate to say that because I know that I am, but I just have never understood how it benefits reporting. It's like marketing should influence 100% of your bookings. I don't understand why that's a board metric.
That is one I've struggled with a lot in my career too, of just, and it's more attribution. Like, you don't need to showcase attribution when you're doing incredible work. People know, you know, your counterpart in sales, your sales team will know if you're having an impact. And I feel like particularly as like companies grow and they get less scrappy, like 50% of people are just spending time showing what they did instead of doing more of the thing.
Look, I think that as sales cycles lengthen and you move up market and it's enterprise deals, I think attribution modeling can help guide what you should be doing, but it shouldn't be used as a success metric. Like, for all the finance people listening, you should use some type of attribution modeling to look at efficiency of spend. Yes. But should we put that in front of the board saying, look how much blank influence? No, because it just like, oh, they went to one dinner. Great. Great. They also had multiple touch points throughout the entire process. And people talk about it all day, and dark social is something that people have talked about for a while. And I just can't get on board. I can't.
Well, hot take, dark social. I haven't heard of it for a while.
I heard it recently a couple times, and I hope that you're right. It's what we talked about earlier. It's like, if I'm talking about all these influence numbers and we're not hitting our revenue number, then who cares? Who cares about any of it, right? But bookings number is what grows companies.
Amen. Attribution should be there to help you
guide,
spend your budget.
Yes.
Guys, yeah. I like it. All right. Last question. It's tough times out there. Still is. I think maybe things are getting a little bit better, but everyone's kind of looking for things that are working in this environment. A lot of the playbook that we've had, traditional channels not working so much.
What's one tactic or strategy that's working for Jellyfish right now?
Dinners, curated dinners, getting our prospect and customer in the room. I mean, it's that, and it's just high quality content production. But ultimately, I think it's just getting people in the room. That works best. It's the relationship building aspect of what we do, which we talked about earlier. I probably would never cut that out of my budget, except for 2020 to 2021, mid 21.
Yeah. It is interesting. A lot of people are talking about it. It's like highly curated executive experiences, dinners. You know, it seems like the oldest marketing, you know, tactic in the books is just like really working again in a meaningful way. I don't know if it was like still pent up from like COVID. People are like, I want to just be in front of people, or people are sick of like just talking to each other on Slack communities and on LinkedIn. Like, people are really responding to in-person.
Yeah, they're responding in person. But I think, again, it comes down to what makes marketing great, which is the experience. It's surprising and delighting people no matter what you're doing. Like, one of our best performing direct mails at Lessonly and at Jellyfish was Legos, because it was something different and people enjoyed it. And it wasn't just some random swag box that I was getting that I threw away half the stuff because I had no idea why somebody sent it to me, right? Like, meaningful things, meaningful conversations at dinners, meaningful stuff they can do with their family and kids, whether that's a game or Legos, just thinking outside of just what can I get in front of somebody to make sure they know who we are. And ultimately, marketing is about creating the best experience possible and helping sales do the deal, right? And that's, and if you're just like mailing in a dinner and hopefully people show up and it's you pitching them at the dinner and they get some great wine, it's not going to do it.
I love Legos as a direct send, because you're creating an experience with that. They're going to do that likely with their kids. That's then going to sit on their kids like dresser. They're going to think about your brand when that comes out. That's a good one. And plus, Legos are one of those like weirdly expensive things that parents are like, I got to go do this. And then it just comes. It's like weirdly expensive and you don't want to spend money on it because it seems like such a funny thing.
I've spent an ungodly amount of money on Legos for my kids because I really wanted them to really like it. And they care more about football. So I'll put the Legos together. They're going to do the sports thing. And it's just something that I think is meaningful for people. And is not just like, there's not, companies just aren't doing it very often. And that's where you set yourself apart.
Well, I appreciate you spending the time, brother. It's always fun to hang out with you. You always leave me with a ton of new ideas, tactics, strategies to think about. I know the listeners are going to like this one. But before I let you go, any roles you're hiring for, anything you want to highlight?
Yeah, I mean, we product marketing, field marketing are two. I mean, if you go to jellyfish.co, all of our roles are there on our career page, but for marketing, product marketing, field marketing.
You're a marketer listening to this, go work for this man. He's an absolute pro and a very good human being. All right, Kyle, appreciate you, man. Go pick up your kids. And for all the listeners, thanks for hanging out with us today. Listening's one thing, executing's different. Hopefully this spurs some ideas for you to go and crush your quarter, have a good year, and we will see you next week.